Welcome, everyone. My name is Heidi Reitmeier. I'm a curator here at Tate Britain. Before I introduce our guests this evening, can I ask two things? One is, can everyone check that their mobile phones are off? And secondly, can I just say, when we have our Q&A together, for documentation reasons, can people please wait for the roving mics? That'd be great. Thank you. I have the great pleasure this evening of welcoming Jan Verwoerd, who lives in Berlin. He works as a freelance contributor to Frieze. He contributes to After All, Metropolis M, and Pictogram, and he teaches at Piet Zat Institute in Rotterdam. And he tells me his recent book, published with MIT and After All, In Search of the Miraculous, is almost sold out. He's, I would say, a very, or more than, reputable and infamous critic, curator, living in Europe. Tom Apps is a painter. She was born in Kiel and has lived and worked in London since 1995. During this year, she's had major solo exhibitions at Greengrassy in London and Kunsthal in Kiel. She's shown at the Berlin Biennial, and of course, with her nomination for the Turner Prize 2006, she's showing here at Tate Britain. Her new work is opening in Cologne in 3 weeks. Tonight, she and Jen have agreed to join us to talk about Toma App's work and the processes and explorations she journeys through while making. So without further ado, can I welcome Jan and Toma? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. Thanks for coming. We thought what we would do tonight is to show paintings and talk about the process in which these paintings are developed. So we will basically begin by looking at a series of paintings together and then gradually develop, I guess, some of the criteria that are important for you, or some of the methods that you use, or the problems that arise in the production of the paintings.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go.
Can we have the first slide, please? Or maybe I have to do it. So I thought I'd start with showing a few of the very first paintings I've made in this particular scale that I've been working on for a few years now. So I think with the first paintings that I've done in that way, you can still see that they're sort of based on, like, I used to make these big grid paintings, and I at some point decided to sort of change my work and work on a smaller and intimate scale, and came to the size, which is 48 by 38 centimeters, which I've sort of stuck to for a few years now. And I somehow started just slowly making shapes, basically, like painting over the top of some sort of grid-based layers that I had underneath. I should say the names of the paintings. This painting is called Kena, and these few first paintings are maybe from 98 to 2001. So basically I was trying to make shapes and connect these elements on the canvas so that there would be a kind of figure. And I started to play with space and illusion. So I would make a shape and then introduce a shadow to kind of break the picture plane. This one is called Ilua. And sometimes I would try to sort of push the image towards something that would nearly look figurative or representational, like this one. I guess reminds you a little bit of a fan. Oh, this one nearly looks like pieces that sit on top of the canvas. This one's called Ento. I first showed these paintings in a small group show at Greengrassy Gallery with two other artists, Gareth Jones and Steve Dawson. I kind of quite like this one piece by this artist, Gareth Jones, because I think there's something similar in his practice to how I go about making a piece just that really in a way we start with nothing, or we just have some materials and then try to make something that can sort of stand for itself or that makes some kind of sense as an object. And this slide tower is his piece, and they are little cubes made of pieces of slide frames, and they are just held together by a jumper that he's taken apart. So it's just wool that he put into those cubes that holds this tower together.
That was Gareth.
That's Gareth Jones, yeah. So I just have a few more paintings, basically. One where you can maybe see that I started to layer more and more to get to some kind of result. Like, in the beginning, it was quite simple for me to make shapes, and that was kind of exciting, but then I somehow started to push it more and more. So with this one, you can see in the middle that there's, I hope you can see it on the photo, that there's a lot of traces of all the layers underneath, and what is left as the painting really is the leftovers of the process a little bit around the edge. Yeah, maybe a similar idea, like the main thing is happening around the edges. Every painting really, for me, has a very different way I go about it and a very different history. So this painting, for example, is one where I have painted, like there's also quite a few layers underneath, but the line is basically leads around areas that I've painted out. That's how I came to this particular farm. And what I generally can say about my process is that I always work inside out, or really most of the time. So what you see as the figure really is painted first. So this line is not painted on top, but it's a remnant of the layers underneath. So the background is painted around that line. Same here, this painting is called Tiad.
So when you say inside out, then sort of you would paint the triangle and leave the space in between the two shapes open, so that it's not like the lines are painted on top of the planes, but the planes are painted and then the lines are like negative spaces.
Lines are negative spaces. Basically, that main gray area that you would conventionally say is the background is actually painted as the last bit. So, yeah, so the triangles are all holes, so to say.
But sometimes I think you can even see it in the paintings, especially the ones up in the exhibition, that, for instance, the lines, well, you can see that there's just less paint on them, that sort of that you see more of the canvas shining through, and that, well, the planes are obviously more solid.
Yeah, I really, in this painting, there's so many layers that you can't really see through to the first stains of the canvas, but I really like it when that happens in paintings. I don't know, maybe the next one. Actually, that has it a little bit, like there's areas where you can see the structure of the canvas, because I mostly start with just staining the canvas with acrylic, with sort of really washy acrylic, and while I work on the composition, more and more layers get buried, but I try to keep it open a little bit, so I kind of try to not suffocate the painting. But sometimes it goes through so many changes that you can't actually see those first bits anymore. But in this one, you can. This one's called Muko. That's an ugly slide. It's called Grün. It happens fairly often in my paintings that I come to this kind of double figure, that somehow there's some kind of mirror reverse effect, or that there's two elements that are kind of mirroring with each other. And I think that has to do with somehow, because I start with nothing really when I make a painting, like there's no shape is defined. I start with something very, very abstract, really just staining of the canvas, a few color fields, and then I come to something more and more precise and defined over a long time and with many layers. So I think something that often helps me to justify an image is that there's something like a double figure going on. This one is called Velf. this one is called Meant. These next few paintings are from, I showed them in a show in Greengrassy, I think that was in 2002, and it was kind of an important show for me because I think with every painting I made a particular discovery or a particular change or felt I got to something new. And this painting, for me, represents a lot of what I'm trying to do because I think it hovers somewhere in between illusion and object. And it reminds you of things, like of representational things, of real things, like a landscape. And even with the light in the painting, I was trying to, like in this particular painting, I wanted to create this daylight effect, so that warm gray with the blue shadows, I thought that was like gives a sort of daylight impression. And somehow it's, for me, in between things that I try to do with my painting, and it's nearly like an image of thinking, like a remnant of the process that then becomes an image of the all the thought processes I've gone through. This painting is called E. That was in the same show. Do you think I should just go on, or should we?
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I should just go on.
Yeah.
You can only now see the very last layers, which is like the dark gray and the white, but it's gone through many changes. At some point, there were a lot of colors involved in this painting. And what was exciting for me was this wasn't even supposed to be the finished painting, really, but it was exciting for me to have such a graphic result and somehow to make the space work without shadows, without all these different colors, tone and tone, but just with two colors and to be able to create this three-dimensional space just with graphic elements. This painting, in a way, highlights the process, like the layering that goes on in my painting is basically emphasized. Like all the lines that you see that are painted in trompe l'oeil were there as a relief before in the painting, but I decided to make that the subject matter of this painting. In this painting, I was particularly interested in creating this with the light of the different blue tones, but also with the composition, a sort of feeling of movement. And I think that mainly actually comes through the different blue tones, that there's that you get an impression that something's moving, that the light is somehow flickering a little bit. And I was excited about having those loose brush strokes in the structure of the painting. This painting is called Tebbe. I think it's from 2002. And I showed it in a small project space of a gallery in Los Angeles with one sculpture by Vincent Fecto. And we, a few years later, we've done a show together in the Van Abbey Museum in Eindhoven, which we're going to talk about later. But that was the first time we've shown something together. And I think there's a lot of similarities in our work and in how we approach making it. This is a painting that I've shown in a little one-person exhibition in New York in the wrong gallery. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a slide of it, but it was just shown in a glass doorway on a street in New York.
I think you mentioned to me once that it's not a coincidence that you choose this portrait format as a format to paint in. And I think I sometimes find, I mean, in this work, it's completely clear, but also in other works that it's, because the format is comparatively small and it's a portrait format, that these images, even though they're abstract, they almost address you like portraits. It is kind of a structure that is that you encounter as if you were looking into somebody's face, which is...
That's definitely a conscious decision that I've decided to make this, my format always portrait format, because something different happens to the space when you have the canvas horizontal, somehow the space, it's automatically landscape, and the space somehow sort of disappears and it doesn't really hold the space so much. And with these, it's like you are confronted by something and the size more or less is sort of head size. So you're kept, when you're looking at the paintings or when I'm working on them, you're kept in this mental scale space.
And it's partly, to me, it talks about this sort of what you said before, that the painting is like a state of mind or like an emotional state, but it's also, I think for me as a viewer, very much about the encounter, how you encounter the work, that even though it's complex and abstract, you encounter it kind of face to face, which gives it a certain definiteness, like, deal with me, look into my face, like, and I think it just creates a particular form of encounter between me and the painting. It would be completely different, as you said, if it's landscape and my eyes are allowed to kind of wander around from left to right and get lost in it, but here it's more like almost like an intersubjective confrontation or exchange.
But it's probably, I have that same intensity when I work on the paintings because they are so small and I sort of sit on the table and keep working on them. Maybe it's that intensity that translates to the viewer as well later.
But you could also say that it's almost a shift in abstract painting. It's not like you're showing me, anything from Kandinsky and Ilyssitsky. It's always kind of abstract painting, like space travel, right? Like it's big open spaces, and you're on a spaceship traveling into the big open space. And then here it's different because it's the space of abstraction. Suddenly, it's the space of intersubjectivity. Mm-hmm. It's an encounter between people, not a space travel into the future. I think that it's kind of a different atmosphere, right? Or when you talk about the colors as the colors of light on a particular day. Yeah. I don't think like in an Ilyssitsky there is no particular day, right?
Yeah.
It's always the future.
Yeah.
It's not kind of the particular light on a kind of slightly dreary Monday morning or something. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of takes abstraction down from heaven to into something that is sort of part of the world that we inhabit as we talk to each other and encounter each other in particular moods, I would say. Yeah?
But I think that probably also has to do with that the paintings have this object quality, because I work on them for such a long time. They are so layered and they've got this surface with all these lines, and so they become almost tactile, and so they are not really only paintings of something that represent a different space, but they are things in themselves. So you're confronted with a thing, with a real thing, like with an object. They're really also not only abstract, really. I think there's always something in them that you can recognize and that somehow feels, maybe it's just a mood, or maybe it's a fairly abstract thought or just a feeling or something, or maybe a thing that you could recognize. So I think they're not only abstract. I guess they confront you because you recognize something.
Yeah. But I remember in a discussion on a roundtable discussion that we recently had with Frances Stark, she mentioned that at some point she went back to using canvas with her collages because she felt that it's important that these things have a body, so that the canvas has a body and that it adds something to an image, especially in a visual culture where we're constantly surrounded by virtual images, right? That sort of we look at images on the screen, at JPEGs, and she was arguing that sort of to give a body back to an image can almost be a sort of a moment, not of resistance, but it's kind of more like a bigger commitment, right? To say like, let's give it a body, let's put it on canvas.
Yeah.
And I sometimes find it interesting to think about like images today, like what are we looking for? Like if we're surrounded by virtual images all the time, so one step would be to maybe give a body back to it, but then it's a body, but it at the same time articulates a certain sense of virtuality, right? Because all these paintings for me are very much about potentials or potentialities, or how forms are growing into potential forms that are very definite in the end, but that could also be different in the next image. So sometimes when you speak about this contradiction about between the painting as a thing and the painting as an image, an abstract image, comes to my mind is this term, I think, that Deleuze sometimes uses when he speaks about, not about virtual realities, but about real virtualities. And when I look at the images, sometimes I feel, okay, that's what they are. They're kind of real virtualities. They are kind of thoughts and like of, no, images of potential constellations, but they have a body, so they're kind of... Mm-hmm.
But I think with me, really, I think with me that physical quality, that body is emphasized not only because it's on canvas, but also because of how I layer the paint,
yeah.
You know, so that the surface becomes so tactile. So I think that adds to it. It's not only the fact that I'm painting, it's also that I'm, you know, the way I make them into an object.
Shall we move on to the... Yeah. Right, because I think it's obvious that the paint, there's really lots of paint on it, and you see that the seams of these things that have been overpainted so many times, that they leave these seams of color in the middle, so that it, all of that seems like it's kind of definite, it's heavy, lots of color, and even the shape in the end looks almost like an ornament or an architecture. But for me, when I started to look at your paintings, I think the sensation was always that sort of at first glance I see something that is really definite,
mm-hmm.
lots of paint, and the shape is ornamental and almost fixed. But then I think this kind of the pleasure of looking at it is that you then suddenly realize that everything that looks so actual and so fixed is actually quite virtual or quite potential, and that it's not, there is not an underlying system. There's completely no system in this at all. It's just the outcome of a completely contingent process where obviously you've taken many decisions and you've even revoked some of these decisions and crossed it out. So everything that at first glance looks completely fixed then turns out to be completely contingent, completely open, and this feeling that someone starts from nothing and slowly builds something that in the end looks fixed, but the longer you look at it, the more it kind of dissolves into that virtuality again.
Yeah.
I find that kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Also, as a step,
I mean,
in...
It's when I make the paintings, all the different the layers that I make are basically, there's always a lot of... a doubt involved. It's basically I start making some shapes and I try to develop a composition, but then something about it doesn't work, so I have to change it again. It could be the color, it could be the shape, and it's trying to make something more and more precise, but I don't actually know when I start out what it is that I want to make more and more precise. So in a way, it's in the end, it's I make something precise that doesn't really exist, or that didn't really exist before, but it looks, in the end, it looks as if it is something. But when I started the painting, I had no idea that it would end up looking like that. And someone has once said to me about the surface that in some paintings it nearly feels to them as if they're alive. And I think that's got to do maybe with what you're trying to describe as well. And maybe with the seams, and that the surface has somehow, it's nearly like a living thing. Someone said that to me.
But I guess that sometimes when I think, like, why should we be considering abstraction today? that's actually the answer that I sometimes find, is that it's, funnily, it's life. It's about life in the sense that it's so much about decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole process of what is decision making about, right? This ethics of decision making. There can be people who make really rigid decisions where they have their system, they've got their principles, so they go through life like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's other people who think, live, and feel maybe more like that you start,
mm-hmm.
and in the process, you're forcing yourself to take decisions, but as you're taking the decisions, you're kind of inventing the criteria how to take them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not kind of, to me, it communicates a kind of a deliberate, intuitive or deliberate decision to not stick with rigid principles, but to decide and develop things as you go along. But it's not drifting at the same time, but it's because you're always forcing yourself to decide about the next step.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, and then the other thing is that...
I mean, for me as a process, it just wouldn't be interesting if I say, for example, a lot of abstract painting used to rely on grids or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's, for me, just it's much too rational for me. That really wouldn't include me as a whole human being. And it's, and for painting, for me, really means to find something that I don't know what it is, and sort of discovering new things. So I always have to try to push it further and further, and to go beyond things that I know. Because in a way, for me, that's the point of making art. You know, that you find out things that you didn't. You know, that you are open for this process of total insecurity.
But what made you take that decision to say, like, okay, I'm done with the grids. No more grids. I'm starting differently.
It was too limited. It was too boring. It was too limited, and it made me feel I've got so many other visual ideas. I've got other moods. I've got other feelings. I've got other. There has to be. You know, I have to find a different process that can show a more complex situation.
But at the same time, I mean, well, obviously, it's abstract painting without grids that produces structures which are obviously structures, but not rational structures.
Are there structures? Is that a good word? I don't know. I guess I really often think of the painting as figures, because most of the time they show one thing. I mean, not always, but a lot of the time they show they're sort of one figure, not in terms of human being figure, but one, you know, more like a mathematical, just one thing on the painting.
Makes sense. But then again, when we're talking about process, of course, that is also almost, yeah, well, it's surprising that normally when you would speak about painting and process, you would see someone doing kind of wild expressive gestures that constantly communicate this is process.
Which I like a lot when I see that in other painting, but it's just not how it works for me.
Yeah.
It's I think somehow it's got to do with this insecurity but there's still the desire to actually to sort of make something that looks very precise and that seems to justify itself. Like, for me, it needs to have this definite shape so that, you know, at least it looks like it justifies its existence.
Oh, it tricks you into believing that it might be justified, and then you look at it and...
Yes. Shall I show another?
Yeah.
This one is called Lure. That's one where I'm trying to make expressive brush strokes. This one is called Yelp. These next few paintings, I've shown them in the exhibition at Greengrassy that was on last winter. So they are the newest paintings. This one is called Libet. It's actually one that I started a long time ago, like maybe even like 10 years ago or something, and then I didn't work on it for quite a while and just finished it recently. And this one is called Nöme. I started to make drawings as well over the last couple of years. I've got some images later, but some of the paintings that I'm working on now and of the paintings in this show featured a lot of lines or revolved around lines, and I think that has to do with that I made a lot of drawings, so some elements of drawings have come into the paintings. This one is called Ebe. And this one is called Müda.
Yes. I think one thing that also is might be interesting is that, I mean, on the one hand, we've been talking about how you start such a painting, that you start without a structure, that you don't have kind of a ready-made set of criteria when you start. But then, of course, another question is when you stop, right? So when you decide when a painting is finished, and the structure that has obviously been changed quite a lot. What exactly makes you decide that the painting is finished, or that this is not just another structure that must be overpainted and reconfigured?
Mm. It's It's a moment, I guess painters know that it feels like everything falls into place, and somehow the for me the paintings suddenly feel like they come alive and they have a mood and they make you feel something when you look at them. But in terms of the actually painting, it often has to do. I've got a lot of elements in each painting. There's a lot of elements I deal with, and along the way, I somehow have to try to negotiate between them. And for example, the colors become more and more subdued, because if there's too much contrast, there's just too much going on. And with this painting, for example, I worked on a long time on the bigger folding sort of structure or line that goes through the painting. And then at some point I introduced this other element of this thin, more optical line and this bright turquoise that I sort of wanted to counteract the other figure. And then it acted in the end as sort of breaking the surface of the painting. And though I think of the thicker line as the main structure, I've made the shadows on the thinner line, which is like the counteracting figure or something like that. So in that way, I'm trying to play those against each other, and I'm trying to sort of balance them in the end. And then sometimes just painterly decisions are what makes a painting interesting to me. Like, for example, in this painting, I like a lot that shadow under the thin line on the top left of the painting, and that towards the right corner, top corner, the colors are kind of fading out. So there is some landscape type space in this painting, but it keeps being broken by the turquoise line. But really, it's when all the elements fall into place and the painting, it feels like the painting becomes independent from me. Like for me, then it feels like it's an object that can sort of justify its existence in the world, and I don't have to do anything to it anymore. It can just be there by itself.
But what do you say? I mean, for me, that's a kind of interesting, not contradiction or paradoxy, or that on the one hand, it's about the fact that a painting is finished when things fall into place, which makes it sound very static, so kind of finished. But on the other hand, you say that obviously it's also true that it's finished when it comes alive, which of course kind of evokes an idea of motion, and it. For me, it is both, right? That it's somehow these shapes, the painting looks finished because there's some quality of definiteness about it. But it's also, it has that spark where you feel like, okay, now there's a rhythm to it and it comes alive. And it, I don't know if it's actually a proper description of it, but to me that somehow feels like at the end the painting kind of goes back to its own beginning. That it kind of shows, okay, this is how I am because this is how I could have been, in a way that mm-hmm. all these shapes are moving, and by being mobile or moving, they suggest like, yeah, actually we could be different, we just ended up in this place, and that's what justifies it. If they would just be hanging around in the painting saying, this is how it is, we just ended up like that, there was no other choice, it would be kind of boring. But if it seems like the quality of motion suggests, yeah, everything could have potentially been different. But this is in the end what justifies its definiteness.
Yeah, I agree.
So I don't know if that's kind of a too philosophical, but I think sometimes what's interesting is when you see how a process invents its own possibility, that normally we would think logically something is first possible and then it's real. And the strange thing about painting is that it's totally real, but when you look at it, it talks about its own possibility by being what it is, and that's kind of fun. What I relate, what these paintings made me think about, it's a drama of becoming, in a way that something that has become fixed talks about its own possibility by saying, could have been different, but this is how it is. And a particular attitude or humor when it comes, as you say, to precision and contingency, or precision and openness and.
But I think that has a lot to do as well with that I don't have a a prescribed process or something like that. Like, I don't have rules. Like, when I start a painting, I just really don't know what it's going to be like. And I start with no sketches, no idea before. So for me, I start always again with nothing. And with every single painting, I go its own particular way. So I think it has that effect because I keep that openness for myself when I make them. Mm.
But still, would you say that it's a dramatic process to make a painting like that, or different?
Sometimes, yeah. It's all kinds of different things. It can be boring. It can be dramatic. It can be difficult. It can be fun. this is a painting where I sort of played with the idea that one of these, that sort of relief trompe-l'oeil painting. This is sort of, at some point I came to the solution for this painting that it's playing with a similar idea, but that within that relief, within that illusion, actually there's some movement and some things are actually coming out more than others. So there's more space than you would actually have in a relief. I've just got 3 or 4 installation shots of that show, but they never really look good with my paintings because they're quite small. So in installation shots, they just seem like these dark spots. and in this exhibition, I also included some drawings that are actually much bigger than the paintings. So this is all different angles in one. It's all in one space. So you see all the paintings and drawings together in one space. And then I've got a few slides of drawings. Like over the past 2 or 3 years, I've made different three series of drawings. And for each series, I've really limited myself to a few elements. Like of these drawings, maybe there's, I don't know, around 25 drawings or something like that, and they are all made with pencil and red, and red color pencil and lines and circles. So in a way, I do what I don't do with the paintings. Like there is a limited set of elements that I decide upon before, and they are made. They are made up like the paintings. Like there's also no idea that I have before, but I make them much quicker. Like, I make the drawings in one go, basically. They are I don't know how many centimeters, they're about sort of poster format, like 80 centimeters by 50 or 60 or something. They don't have titles. I think that's the last slide, so maybe we could look at the other images. All the next photos are from an exhibition I did, I think, about 2 years ago, in the Van Abbe Museum in Eindhoven, together with Vincent Fecto. He's an artist who lives in San Francisco, and I showed that little slide before where I'm showing one painting and he's showing one of his pieces. And we were invited to do, it's kind of like a two-person show, and part of the offer was that we could use the works in the collection of the museum and curate exhibitions around our work if we wanted, and we were really excited about this. So we got 4 spaces, and the first space is this one that we're looking at now. It's the room that Vincent Fecto curated. Then we have a room with Vincent's work, and then a room with my work, and then the last room is with works that I have selected from the collection, and we ended up working on it all together, and we ended up putting pieces of ours in those rooms too. So this, in this first room, is those are some of my drawings, and Vincent chose this is a sculpture by this artist called Dieter Roth.
Can you maybe explain what was...
Yeah, I was just trying to show the next one because you can see a little bit more. It's that piece is, it's, I think it's called Sausage Clouds or something like that. It's and slices of ham in between glass and the oil paint.
And it's rotting away.
And it's, yeah, it's rotting away. It's from the 70s, I guess. And then I actually chose that canvas by Daniel Buren, which is part of a bigger piece, but you could show single canvases. So this was one piece that I put into his room. You can sort of see through to his room, but on the right... Oh, no, I'm not doing this anymore, am I? Can we have the next image? I don't know, can we stay at the one before? Sorry, stop. I think the artist on the left is called John Kermeling, and the one on the right, I can't remember now, but they're both Dutch artists. And I felt really, really connected to all the pieces that Vincent chose for his room, because I think really we think about art really in really similar ways. So I have... I had really a connection to this Dieter Roth piece with the ham slices, and I can see why he chose this piece with a rope, because I'm interested in that kind of illustration and in and sort of making something in a painting look like a real thing. Can we have the next? This is Vincent's room, and he works similarly to me in a way that he, I guess there's references to architecture, so there's some kind of starting point, but he goes about it in the same way. He doesn't know what they will look like. He just starts by making some shape, and then he adds stuff and takes things away, and I think it's also just really, in the end, the object is nearly like the visible thought process that he's gone through. Can we have the next? And the next one? The next two are this one, and the next images are from MySpace. It just had six paintings. Can we have the next one? So when I actually choose a group of paintings, it's difficult to see in these two slides, but there's always a connection between all the paintings when I make a group of paintings. Like for the Turner Prize exhibition, it's not an arbitrary choice of paintings. It's not that I choose 11 any paintings I can sort of think of, but I make really a specific decision about the whole mood of the exhibition and about the connections between the paintings, like connections and like formal connections or color connections or a mood, so it's not arbitrary when I make a group. It nearly feels like making a new painting. Can we have the next? This is the room that I curated. So it's also got pieces by Vincent in it, these two. And then on the... Can we have the next one? I think this artist is called Erik Pape. He's from Holland. And for me, there were a lot of parallels to my paintings in this piece, because it's... the image is congruent with the object. So he basically painted in one-to-one size this window, so the image itself becomes the object of the painting, kind of like in a Jasper Johns painting. No, I'm not finished. Can I have the next one? Then there was this painting by On Kavara. The next one, please. One of the date paintings, which I hung next to the door, so it have a connection to real life, because in the painting it's the date is about a real day. Can I have the next one? And this, the way I chose the Daniel Buren painting for Vincent's curated show, he chose this photo by Lothar Baumgarten for this room, and I think there was a nice connection between the shadow. I think the painting is called Cross Shadow or something. So I think we like the idea that there's something that it feels a little bit magic, and that there's this dark area. And I think in that sculpture, this black sculpture by Vincent, there was like a similar effect, like you looked into this dark void, then this sort of undefinable space. And then there's a couple more images. Can I have the next one? And this piece is by the Polish artist Andrzej Kadera, who I think it's from the 70s also, I'm not sure, but he used to make these sticks I think there's some mathematical order or something, it's not random colors, and he would take them from exhibition to exhibition. Like when friends of his had shows, he would turn up with these walking sticks, and I think later they were placed in exhibitions too, but I think in the beginning they were about this idea of like the anti-object, basically not really showing something but still sort of turning up with an object at a show. I think the next two images are just of the same piece because I like it so much. I think what interests me about this stick is somehow that it's through, because it's been in these different places, that somehow it's accumulated some energy or something like that.
Shall we go back to the first? Can we go back to the first image on the? Thank you. But for me, when I see this combination of your drawings and the Dieter Roth, so it brings me back to this idea of drawing or abstraction as a form of embodiment, almost, which you would at first glance think is kind of contradictory, because we have learned through the history of modernism that abstraction should be about dematerialization and the spiritual, and that it seems that maybe when we reinvent abstraction today, it's a completely different register, and that it's no longer about sort of abstraction leaving the body and opening up some kind of fancy spiritual world, but it is actually about a form of embodiment, as you said, that it's about moods and memories, like the Kadea thing, that it's an abstract object, but still it's an object, and it accumulates a certain memory.
I mean, I don't even really think of myself in terms of being an abstract painter. I'm just sort of making paintings, and I don't know, you know, I'm making them to find out what they might be about.
But when you chose the Dieter Roth work, how did you relate to the work, or what?
I think that's the Dieter Roth work. That was Vincent's decision.
Okay.
I like it a lot. Yeah, I think it's just because it's a really strange object, and it's really beautiful. Though it's made up of these disgusting things, you know, this old ham and.
But it's kind of really physical. And it talks about life and obviously about death, about decay.
Yeah.
But then it's quite cool in its form of expression.
Yeah.
And it's pretty dramatic, but then it's also kind of relaxed and cool and formal.
Mm-hmm.
And that would start me thinking again about this notion of drama, or like that we talked about. When I look at these things together, I would say like they're all dramatic works, it's just that they stage a different drama.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I also find fascinating, to say like, okay, when we think about the drama of life, the drama of decision making, the drama of thinking, the drama of feeling, we usually think in terms of melodrama, melodramatic scenarios. Mm-hmm. What is life, what are emotions about,
and then, mm-hmm.
and then
so
string music and wind and but to say like, okay, let's change the register of drummer, let's have a different sound, and use a register of drummer or a sound that sounds pretty cool.
So you think that this, like both Vincent and me and all the works that we chose, that there's some kind of restraint to them, basically. Though there is that drama in them, they're formally restrained, and that's how we work.
On the one hand, yes, but on the other hand, I would probably never use the word restrained, because restrained sounds so much like you are kind of self-controlled and you're not permitting yourself to live out what you would otherwise live out if you were not restrained.
And
obviously the work is about kind of doing exactly what you want to do.
Yeah.
And that's, again, would be kind of, I would say, part of shifting the register of drama, that it's not this old, it's not no longer sticking to the rules of this old dichotomy that you're either expressive, out of control, unrestrained, or kind of restrained and anal and control fetishist, but it's trying to do away with this logic of old contradictions and to say like, you can be unrestrainedly rationally emotional or emotionally rational in a very precise, unrestrained way.
Yeah.
And that it tries to inhabit a new sense of contradictions and thereby also shows another ethics of decision making or of being and feeling. Mm. That's all pretty abstract. No,
but I think there's probably too much reflection when artists, like when a painter would stand up in front of a canvas, like he couldn't do like a Pollock or something like that, because there's too much reflection going on now. I think there's, you wouldn't be able to do that.
But why would you want to do it?
Yeah, it's probably not the time anymore.
Or would you want to do a Pollock?
Once in a while? Never really sort of... it never really happens that way. I really like it, but for me it doesn't happen that way, no.
But I would argue, I guess not even argue, that's the way how I feel, that I think that sometimes something that is at stake in art production, or I would maybe even say like for myself in writing, is... It's you can call it maybe an ethics, a kind of a style of doing things that is not just about personal preferences or kind of what you fancy, what you prefer, but what you think is possible for you and yourself at a given moment. And I think that's a big commitment to say, like, okay, I want to show and express what forms of expression are possible for me at a given moment, and by doing that, maybe also sort of to try and leave all distinctions behind. So like I refuse to be kind of objectified according to a certain logic of, okay, if you're abstract, you're rationalist, and if you are kind of messy, you're kind of an uninhibited individualist. But like to say like, let's do away with all these artificial distinctions and let's find a form of thinking, being, and making forms that follows a different logic. I know something that I always like about, I would say like about criticism, or what I would call critical art, is I once learned, I came across the definition of what critical, where the term critique or criticism comes from, and that it's actually related to this idea of crisis. So the crisis in, I never learned classic ancient Greek, but apparently crisis is a situation which is so undecided that it demands a decision to be made, right? So a crisis would be a point where a decision is impending, but it is not yet made, but everybody feels like it's in the air, the decision must be taken. And then when the crisis emerges, it emerges and produces a criterion. And funnily enough, a criterion apparently in this ancient philosophy or medicine even or ancient law, Greek law, a criterion is also a site. A criterion would be the court, the courtroom. The criterion is the stage on which the crisis is then staged, only to produce criteria, that is kind of principles of judgment. And for me, this is what happens. Yeah, can happen, especially in abstract painting, that the, mm-hmm. the painting itself becomes critical because it is a criterion. It is the stage on which a kind of crisis is then staged.
But then also, basically, do you mean as well for my process? Like when I'm in the studio, I have to, when basically there's a constant crisis and that forces me to constant decision making.
Yeah.
So I develop my own criteria for my paintings. So that could be a formal thing. So basically, I also develop my own formal means of how to solve that.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I mean. But then the solution is actually the criterion. And when I look at the images, I sometimes feel like, okay, I experience this crisis, but in another register of drama. And what I get in the end are maybe not solutions, but visualized criteria. So that all these figures, as you call them, they are criteria. So that they are manifest criteria because they testify to a process of decision making.
Yeah.
So it's the crisis, it's the criteria on the side, and the the figures as visualized manifest criteria.
Yeah.
Because they talk about decision making and a different drama. I would say.
Yeah. I like that idea.
Maybe before we continue, we should open it up to the audience.
Yeah, sure.
Do you have a question?
You say your paint's very thick, but it's not the kind of Auerbach sort of layering it on. It looks very controlled, and there are bits where it looks as if you've got maybe pieces of tape underneath. I presume they're not pieces of tape, they're just the way the paint's layered. But do you kind of deliberately seek that effect thing? So it looks as if it must be a very deliberate.
No, I absolutely don't seek that as an effect. It's only there because of my process, because I make so many layers and I change the composition a lot. So I, in a way, I often wish those traces weren't there, but they are there because they were necessary by, like on the way of finding that form. And there's never a tape anywhere. It's just because I paint the lines by hand, and the more times I go over the same shape, the thicker the edge becomes. So it's not something, it's not an effect, it's something that has to be there because of how I make them. It's no decoration.
But then when you add these shadows, of course they are almost like effects, right? Do you think about them as effects? Like when you put a shadow somewhere to create this illusion of spatiality.
Yeah, I guess sometimes a little bit, but they are really part of making the space of the paintings ambiguous. So that you can't identify what the foreground is, what the background is, and that you are sort of keep being in this constant movement of trying to work out what the space, how the space functions in the paintings. So they have a function, but they are. Yeah, they're a little bit more of an effect than the traces because they are just there from the process.
Because a classical modernist would probably say, like, no effects, no tricks, that makes the painting impure. But this is not a principle that you would have. You feel that you can cheat if you want to, or can play tricks.
Yes. They don't have to be pure.
Sorry, you said you don't use any masking tape in your work?
No.
So, and you don't use any tools, any like curve tools or curve?
Sometimes I make a drawing, draw a line before.
Because they look really very precise.
Yeah, but it's all painted by hand.
Okay.
But I like that. I think I like that because I guess I think I like that energy that happens when you have to concentrate on making these lines. So I think the paintings maybe accumulate over many layers some kind of energy by the concentration I put into the paintings. I don't know, but maybe.
Okay, I have another question. How much do you think your drawings influence your work?
Sorry, say that again.
How much do you think your drawings influence your paintings?
It's never that they ever work as sketches for the paintings, But I think something like a color preference might come into it, and especially recently I've made a lot of paintings that feature lines. So I think somehow the drawing process has crept into the painting process a little bit.
Can you talk about the titles of the paintings at all?
The titles of the paintings are first names, and they come from a particular area. So I've got a dictionary from a particular area, and I choose them. I sort of make them suit the painting, so I choose them according to formal elements in the paintings, or according to the mood, or according to something that the painting might remind me of. But when I first made those paintings, I just didn't want to number them, and I didn't want to describe them, and I didn't want to call them Green Triangle or whatever. So the name Solution seemed very suited. And also because they're such individual pieces when I work on them. So it somehow seemed to work. But I tried to choose titles that are as abstract as possible and that don't sound necessarily male or female.
But it was interesting earlier because Jan was talking about them as you were talking about in the paintings, the kind of subjects. Do you ever think of them as kind of characters with those titles, those names?
I guess not really, no. I think it's more really when I think of the name, it's often more a sound according to the mood of the painting. But not really. I don't really think of them as characters, and therefore they have names. No.
You mentioned that you've done a few paintings recently with a lot of lines. I wanted to know whether the plane were put after the lines also in those paintings, as you were mentioning earlier.
Oh, what do you mean, that if I paint the background still over, and yes. Yes, so the lines are always in the painted earlier.
Hi. Do you never get bored? Do you never think, I must spin this around, or I must do a much bigger one now?
No, I don't actually. I sometimes try to make bigger paintings, but no, I still have a lot of ideas for these paintings.
How long have you been doing them at this size?
Since 98, maybe. It just seemed right, that format for these paintings. So though I try different formats sometimes, I always come back to this.
I mean, you also mentioned Onkar Vara, who was also always doing these day paintings in the same format.
So they're not always exactly the same, but they are, you know, always between this and this, maybe.
So would you even say that this sort of adds conceptual dimension to the choice, or would you consider that as a conceptual choice to limit your means or your format by saying, I'm going to stay with that in a similar way?
Yes, I think on the one hand that is a conceptual choice, but then on the other hand also it gives me a certain freedom because the paintings are so open and I start from nothing every time, so there's at least one basic thing that is already decided, so from there that just gives me more freedom that I've made that decision already.
Yeah. Does the political, economical, or social context of today affect your work, or you want to leave it aside, you know?
I'm absolutely sure that it does, but I would not put that into my paintings in any didactic. Like, I've never really been someone who's interested in an art being didactic in any way and putting a message across, but I think it has to do more with that you are making something happen in the paintings that makes something happen. For the viewer, when they look at them, that opens up, a particular mind space, so that it changes something in the viewer's perception. So I think for me that makes more than as if I would put a whatever political message into my paintings or something like that. For me that's very flat and didactic. So it's I think that openness that I try to keep and that I try to create for the viewer, for me I think there's more that happens in for them, hopefully.
But maybe that's also why I wanted to suggest this kind of category of the ethical, in the sense that I find these works talk to me about a particular attitude to thinking, to principles, how you want to deal with structures by leaving them away. So sometimes I feel like an abstract painting can be a really a declaration of a very subtle form of anti-authoritarian attitudes, so that it is a commitment to a certain way of being and thinking, which then translates also into a kind of intersubjective encounter. So it's not just saying like, here, this is how I am, but because you're addressing somebody in a particular way, creating almost a social contract between the viewer and the painting, but in a social contract that is set up according to very particular terms, that a social contract that is both about being decided and open. And I find that this is the moment when sort of you have an abstract painting can be about a personal ethics and can open up a social situation in the encounter. All of that is really abstract, but in the end, I think a lot of social processes in the end are about attitudes and particular forms of dealing with each other. And I would say, like, I can't see why we shouldn't experience that on such an abstract way, or feel encouraged to be kind of decided and open as an attitude to things, people. And of course, it's kind of proto-political in the sense that it encourages you to kind of approach things and people in a particular way. Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I've just got a couple of simple questions. How long do you spend on a painting, and do you tackle more than one at once?
I work on a lot of paintings at the same time. I mean, I don't know, 30, 40 maybe. And I have them over a lot of years. So sometimes, I mean, I don't know, it just varies, a few years. But sometimes I work on one and then I don't work on it for a couple of years, so it doesn't. It really varies, but for quite a long time.
Go ahead.
It's interesting, you talk a lot about the space, and I'm glad we're now talking about time. And I think it was really interesting to bring the Ankara painting in the context, because to me, some of your paintings are very long and languorous and slow almost, or they have a kind of a long time frame implied. Others feel a little more quick or jarring. And somehow I'd love you both in a way to comment on this and its relation perhaps to art history and the time zone of your paintings in relation to the history of painting. It's been a while since I studied art history and it's all a little foggy and I'd love a tune up.
Actually, can I quickly say something? I think that doesn't really that directly relate to your question, but I used to make films. I used to make 16mm films, sort of like structuralist films. So there is sort of a history in my own work that I was actually for some time dealing with movement. And I used to make sort of multi-panel paintings that were about different speeds. So that aspect of time and quick and slow and movement was actually sort of in area of research for a while in my paintings before I started to make these paintings. And I think that has come into this work as well, that I always think of them as every part of the picture plane somehow is involved in some kind of movement, and that ambiguous space is part of that movement.
Which I guess is interesting, because I think you could say that about a lot of new painting that has emerged in the mid-90s, that it's people sometimes coming back from the moving image, right? So that sort of in like 80s, early 90s, maybe a lot of people were discussing what an image is and what an image could be by using video. And then maybe suddenly there was this rediscovery, if we want to talk about the potentials of images, there's a medium that is actually pretty useful because you can do a lot of stuff with it. It's painting. Yeah? So and then we maybe have a rediscovery of painting after video or after film, which I find pretty symptomatic in a...
Mm-hmm. maybe the question was, maybe it was implying that my paintings slow that down again, I don't know, or something, that coming back from film, it goes the opposite way and slows down again.
But also speaking about slowness and maybe even back to ethics and ethics of slowness, that I sometimes find that this is again constructing a context for it, but to say like, okay, we live today in an age of compulsive performativity, of just-in-time production, so we need to be quick, you need to stand and deliver all the time. And the one thing that maybe is even a form of resistance against that compulsive performativity, I think, is latency, because what we are not allowed to do anymore is be latent, because we have to actualize all our potentials constantly. We have to show how we are, what we can do, and we have to be quick. And the moment to say, like, to work on a painting for many years and to work on paintings that are not just about slowness, but I think very much about latency, right? About what things are and could be and might have been, I think this is pretty provocative in a moment when our society starts to be much more about sort of quick performance and just-in-time production. So I would see sort of a celebration of latencies and slowness as a, it's pretty rigid oppositions, but I think it's there is a quality in kind of making a case for latency and slowness and something that is not completely dissolved into fast and quick actions or gestures.
Yeah. Can you say something about the importance of the layering and the creation of illusion, the illusion of an object? Earlier you said something about not wishing to suffocate the underpainting, and that would kind of, I suggest, a fear of something being lost. So could you say something about what is precious about these elements to you?
Yes, I guess I constantly, when I build up something, in the first few layers, in the beginning of the paintings, I feel really much freer because there's not so much to lose yet, basically, because I haven't worked on it for such a long time and I don't really quite know where it's going, so I can try more. But the further along I am with the painting, the more difficult it becomes to change things because I've gone quite far with the composition and because it started to become meaningful to me, but the painting still doesn't work. So then I have to be able to still take that risk of losing everything to maybe try to find a solution. And the layering really is, it's part of finding that ultimate criterion. It's not that I want to put myself through this endless layering. I would also be happy if I would come to that solution much quicker, really. But it just doesn't work like that. And
Can I say we've got time for two more questions?
Okay. Just quickly, because you said, on the one hand, it seems like the underpainting, it sometimes has qualities that you want to save, but these qualities only emerge in the end, right? And then it's not a thing that has value in itself, or because sometimes that is paintings when you just destroy everything and completely shut off the surface and just cover it all over this.
I mean, for me, there's a lot of parts of the along the way that are beautiful or exciting and that I would like to keep, but they wouldn't work for the final painting, so I have to unfortunately lose them. And I often it happens that I have to overpaint the whole painting, but I like it when there's still these gaps to the first surface. But I can't always keep them, really.
How is the way you paint affect your life? I mean, decision making. Are you obsessed similarly?
I don't
sure
know.
Sorry, I know it's personal, but it's very interesting.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what to answer.
I'm interested in the fact that your drawings seem to contain a lot of right angles and circles, and your paintings contain a lot of triangles. and slightly more organic shapes. Is it because the paintings more or less grow organically, or do you make a conscious decision to do basically
I think it probably has to do with that in a drawing, that it's a different medium, so you have paper, you have a big sheet of paper, so in a way to make a composition or to mark space in the paper, it's a very direct way to just make a straight line. Maybe it's just got to do with that.
I think perhaps it might be time for us to have a drink, but to thank Jan and Toma for their insights and generosity this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. Can I say that there is wine outside, and also that we have two more Turner Prize talks, one next Wednesday with Rebecca Warren and the following Wednesday with Phil Collins, so please do join us. Thanks very much, and thanks for your attention and questions. Thanks.